Welcome to the award-winning Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100-degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. People still going on about it being dangerous, having boiling hot water straight from a tap. Well, I can tell you it's not. In fact, my friend Michael was over last week, who is a fully grown adult, and he couldn't get it to work. So he couldn't get any hot water out of the blooming thing. And now I'm making it sound like it's difficult. It's really not. It's just got a, what do they call it? They call it a push and twist combination. So you have to push the little thing and twist it, and then the water comes out. It's not connected to the actual tap bit, which makes your water come out, you know, like your regular water. So, yeah, that function means kids can't just go in there and scald themselves. You can't turn it on by accident. It just doesn't work like that. You cannot do that. So it's really very safe. It's a seriously good bit of kit, by the way. It really is. Mine also does filtered water, still and sparkling. So I would never dream of buying bottled water again. If you can afford one, go to cooker.co.uk to look at the different models. That's cooker.co.uk to look at the different models. The black one is very cool. Can you imagine having a black tap in your kitchen? I could never imagine it, but now I can because I've seen it. I'd also like you to email me. I haven't had as many emails as I normally get, so I think people are forgetting to get involved. I would like to hear from you, whether you like it, whether you don't like it, the sort of guests, anything any of the guests have said. It's always good. I'll try and do a catch-up email, podcast soon. Maybe I'll do a midweek Mark or something and have a chat with him about some of the stuff that people are talking about. Get an email over. Do it to lovejoyhour@gmail.com. lovejoyhour@gmail.com. That's a good email address to use. On today's hour, I'm curious about the ownership of color. Right, so this might take some explaining. I sort of came upon this story when I was served an advert on Instagram. It involves two artists and a bit of a war. The artist Sir Anish Kapoor bought the rights to a type of black paint and wouldn't let anyone else use it. No other artists were allowed to use it. It was the blackest black paint, apparently. The artist Stuart Semple was outraged and invented a blacker black paint, which anyone can buy apart from Anish Kapoor. That really amused me. I thought, look, I'm going to have to find out more about this story. Because the idea that you can own a paint or a colour, I mean, you know, a regular listener knows this, the idea that we're allowed to own anything is just a bit beyond me. You know, like copyright and patenting laws are just a bit weird. But let's talk to Stuart Semple about it. Let me tell you a bit about it. He is a multidisciplinary British artist working across painting, sculpture, happenings, technology, and activism. He is well known for his sociological engaged works that often discuss youth politics, accessibility, and democracy. Although diverse in its presentation, Semple's body of work orbits around a handful of recurring themes: anxiety, society, cultural history, technology, connection, community, and freedom, ultimately landing with a clear-minded sense of utility. The art itself should be a social function. Semple is well known for utilizing the internet as a performance space via such projects as The Pinkest Pink and The Blackest Black. When he did The Pinkest Pink, Anish Kapoor wasn't allowed to buy that either, but he managed to get himself a pot of it and he stuck his middle finger in it and stuck it up to Stuart. So I like all that stuff. Look, you got to check out some of Stuart's work if you don't know. It is very good. And you need to go to culturehustle.com. That is his ongoing project to liberate all art materials and arguably one of the most enduring internet performances of all time, as it says here. Go there and you can see all the colors he's done. He's done the pinkest pink, the whitest white, the blackest black, the glitteriest glitter, the orangest orange, and blah, blah, blah. He's done a whole lot of them. And I think it's just a really fascinating subject. Anyway, let's meet him here, Stuart. Hello, Stuart. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you doing?
Are you in your studio?
I am in my studio.
I got an email off you the other day. You said, because I bought a product off you, the Blackest Black, which I love, by the way.
Thank you.
It's fascinated me so much that I painted a circling my kitchen table, which is covered in paint, by the way, because it was when my kids started doing their art at school, I just sort of let them paint on the table and it just made it full of character and life. And I love it. So it's got splodges of paint everywhere and scrapes in it and glitter and all sorts of stuff. And I thought I'd buy some of your paint and it really stands out actually because it's so matte. I don't know really where the word to describe it, but I'm sure we'll go.
I suppose that's it.
So first of all, you're in your studio. I got an email off you the other day. You do work every day, don't you?
Yeah.
You set yourself a task, so it's like a proper job.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be like that for me. Otherwise, if I fall off it, I can't get back on it, you know. So, yeah, got to do something every day, practice.
Right, I've got so much to talk to you about, but I'd like to start where the intrigue for me started when I was served an ad on Instagram saying this is the blackest black, and I loved that concept. I was like, what the hell does the blackest black mean, 3.0? So I clicked on it. So it worked, by the way, your advert, because I clicked on it and thought, what does it mean, the blackest black? And then when I got into the story with you having a little fight with Sir Anish Kapoor, I just was absolutely fascinated by it. So I sort of told the story a bit in my intro, but do you mind just expanding on it for us?
Of course. What do you want to know about? Where should I start?
How has he got to own this paint, and then why were you so angry about it?
I mean, I think
how has he got to own the paint?
Well, the first thing is that he didn't invent the paint. He just paid money to be the only artist in the world to be able to use it. So there was a company in England called Surrey Nanosystems that developed this stuff. I wouldn't even call it paint. It absorbs 99.9% of visible light. So he basically paid them a ton of money to be the only person who makes art that could use that stuff. Why I got so annoyed about it is because it's absolutely the problem with the art world. You know, you've got these super elite billionaire artists sort of dominating what people can and can't express themselves with. It just felt sort of morally wrong.
We have to state at this time, if people don't know you and your work, you're actually very successful too, though, aren't you? So you're fighting on behalf of other people, I suppose, other artists who would like to use it.
Yeah, I think all artists should have access to things like that.
So I suppose the one thing we have to say is I don't know what you think of his art, but I was looking at it the other day because I knew I was talking to you. It is good, isn't it? I mean, I do like what he's done with the paint. And I suppose if everybody... Go on, you don't like it.
No. Do you know what? I love a lot of the things he's made. Not everything he makes. I don't love everything every artist does. But no, he's made some absolutely banging stuff in his time. There's no doubt about that.
But the problem is, it's quite simplistic, I suppose, in a way, because he's painted it using this paint. And then if you have ownership to the paint, then it takes away from his art. I suppose that's his argument, is it?
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, the material does all the work for you. He's painted a 3D thing that now looks flat because he's used the paint. But any artist in the world could do that if they could afford to buy the stuff. So it's a weird one, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So then tell me how you got to start inventing your own colours then. So that annoyed you enough that you thought, right, I'm going to start making my own colours. Go on.
Yeah, no, not quite, because I was making my own paint since I was 4 or 5 years old. So I've always made my own colours. And I've been obsessed with that since I was a very young child. So I've been making paint a long, 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 long time. So it wasn't the fact he did that that suddenly made me decide to make paint, but it was that that made me decide to share some of my paint with other artists on the internet. I just made it for myself.
Right, so excuse my ignorance, how do you make paint?
Well, it depends what sort of paint. So simply it can be like a base, so it could even be olive oil, and then some sort of colourant, beetroot, basic paint, all the way up to very complicated formulas that have hundreds of ingredients and complicated processes and technology involved and processing. And
right. So Anish Kapoor's black paint, it's, well, you say you're not even sure it's a paint, but the way that works is by retaining light and not reflecting it. And that's what made it so black. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So a black thing absorbs lots of light and a white thing reflects lots of light. And the more light that gets trapped in the black thing, the blacker it looks. And his work's like that. It creates a kind of forest of these particles. When the light goes in, it gets stuck inside and it can't get back out. And that looks very dark.
So I love the idea that you went on to... Is the first one that you created to annoy Anish Kapoor was the pinkest pink? Was that the one that you said, we've invented this paint and anyone can buy it, but apart from Anish Kapoor? Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct, yes. That was the first one. And anyone could buy it apart from him, even though the dirty rotter got his hands on it in the end. But basically, yes.
He got his hands on it and then he stuck his middle finger at it. And did the fuck off to you.
That's exactly what he did wrong there. That's what he went and did.
Which is just fantastic. I love it because I do think it's nice when the world of, I like it when there's a little bit of controversy going on in the world of art, you know, music. Music seems very bland at the moment. It was much better when all the bands were like, you know, speaking to each other, shall we say. Critiquing each other's work.
I want another Blur versus Oasis moment. It's ridiculous. It's a bit boring.
So then you went on to do The Whitest White, did you? And then The Blackest Black. And now is your black blacker than Anish Kapoor's?
Not quite. It's a tiny couple of percent less black than Anish Kapoor's, but the difference is you can actually use my black with a paintbrush and it's affordable and you don't need a lab or a nuclear reactor or a flipping whatever it is, vacuum chamber. So your eyes can't tell the difference. You can only measure the difference in a lab.
Right. And how did you go about making that then? Do you have a load of chemists who you work with?
That one was, yes, I do have chemists I collaborate with very much so. But that one, I came up with the formula for it and I knew it would work, but I didn't really know how to make it. So I worked with the art community on the internet and we sent it to lots of artists and they all told us what they thought and how we could change it. And I evolved it with about 1,000 artists around the world, helped me develop it.
Right, that's amazing. And you've also did a blue, because we're going to get into this in a minute, but a lot of people have registered colours in the past. And in 1960, Yves Klein registered a formulation of Klein Blue, which meant no other artist could use it. So it's not a new thing, is it? It's been done for a long time.
Yeah, but just because something's been going on for a while doesn't mean it's right.
Which is interesting. So I'll come on to that in a minute. But so we've got you've got on your website the five worst owned colours of all time, and I was quite astonished by these. And it is so absolutely bizarre for all of us mere mortals who aren't artists to actually comprehend the idea of people owning a colour. It seems completely insane to me. You know, it seems as stupid as saying...
It is insane!
It seems as stupid as saying I own bread or I own... You know, it's like, it's mental. So the Barbie pink is obviously a type of pink which was 1997, was it? That was...
I believe so.
They decided... Yeah, then you've got Tiffany Blue. We all know the Tiffany Blue colour. They use their boxes and things. And you've made your own version of that, haven't you? Which they've copyrighted or patented. You've got T-Mobile, Magenta, they've done theirs. Mm. You've got Anish Kapoor's, obviously, as you know. And, oh no, is it Fanta Black? Is that Anish Kapoor's? Is that the one? Or is that another?
Yeah, that's his. That's what it's called. No, that's it. That's Kapoor's one, Fanta Black. That's what they call it.
And then Post-it Canary Yellow. They've trademarked their yellow, the Post-it notes. I mean, it's absolutely incredible.
I know. It's ludicrous.
What do you think about copyright as total and patenting as total? Because I've discussed this on this podcast a few times and I can't quite get my head around it. But I worry that our obsession with ownership could actually be a problem for the world anyway, because what you end up with is a very small amount of people owning a lot of the stuff. And when you move it into technology, so a smartphone or something, you say, I'm the only one allowed to own that technology. We're not open sourcing it. That becomes a bit of a problem, because what you do is you alienate lesser developed countries immediately from the equation, because you're selling it for a price for this section of the world population and not that section. So you're automatic, and as I say, it's ridiculous to me in my mind. as the idea of owning bread. If you could say, if the Egyptians said, look, we've made this thing called bread, we've copyrighted it. And I know that might sound stupid to some of the listeners here, but there was a bloke in America trying to copyright a version of corn, by the way, or patent it. I'm using both words connected to each other because I feel they are sort of slightly connected. But this whole idea of humans and ownership is quite a bizarre scenario. What do you actually think about it as a total?
As a total, what the concept of ownership in general?
Yeah, of ideas and things.
Well, I think it depends what it is, you know. I think some things are different than other things. So, it's hard to talk about it in a total. I mean, some things people put a lot of love and time into and they dedicate their lives to them and they care about them. And maybe those things should be protected to an extent. But there are other things that I see as the ingredients of making other things. And I think that's different. So that's maybe the code in your tech or the colour of the paint that the artist uses or the note that a musician plays. And I don't think you can own the fundamental building blocks of something, especially if it enables people to express themselves. I mean, that doesn't seem morally right to me, to hinder the creative expression of a human being.
Yeah, it's really interesting you talk about music, because if you want ownership of a note, the whole hip-hop movement would not have happened if people couldn't sample and steal other people's music. That was what it was. Let's steal somebody else's music and turn it into another song. Now it's becoming increasingly more difficult for artists to do that, and I don't think you would have had such a vibrant hip-hop movement as you did years ago because of that. And then if you look into the art world, Andy Warhol, for instance, his art was all stolen. Like the Campbell soup cans were not his, that wasn't his logos. And the pictures of Marilyn Monroe and all the Elvis Presley, none of them were his pictures. He just took iconic photos and turned them into his art. Now, should he have been allowed to do that? In this day and age, I imagine people would go, you're not allowed to do that. It's my photo. You've got to pay me for it.
Well, I think it's really important that he did that. What he was doing was moving things out of mass culture and bringing them into art so that we can look at them, so we can consider them, so that they live outside history. It's a really important thing to do. Like the sampling thing was vital. It's how human beings make sense of our history. We need to be able to reinterpret the past. It's fundamental doing that.
Yeah. So what I'm saying, are we worried that we're going far too much down the line of ownership of these things so that we can't create that sort of art anymore?
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, I think you're right. I think we are. But I think the other thing is nobody's stealing anything because nothing. Look, if you've got a bike and I come round to nick your bike, you no longer have a bike. If I come round to make a copy of your bike, you've still got a bike and I've got one too. How is that morally wrong? We've both benefited. That's sharing. That's different.
Well, I suppose if you're trying to make money out of something being only a small amount of them, then, you know, if there's only one bike, it's worth more than if there's 10,000 bikes. And I suppose that's always what's happening with these things. And also, if I own the rights to the bike, then I can say to you, you can have another bike, but you've got to pay me first for the ownership of the bike. That's where we've gone with the world. I know it's a complicated subject, but that's what intrigues me by, you know, Anish Kapoor, I'm sure, is not a horrible person, yet he feels that he needs to have ownership of that paint to keep his art solid somehow. And I get that, you know, the more times Jeff Hurst signs an autograph for, you know, scoring the hat-trick in the World Cup, the less they're worth. So, you know, the amount, if he can limit his autograph to one a year, then it's worth more. You know where I'm coming from. So
I do. But it's just, if we don't start sharing what we've got, we're going to be knackered. We're going off the edge of a cliff. You know, this greed thing and this more is better isn't going to work. It's not this is mine, hands off anymore. It's this is ours, let's all join in.
Do you know what? I couldn't agree with you more. And I think open sourcing, there's always the argument against open sourcing when it comes to anything like drugs or technology. They say, well, we put all the work in, and if we don't charge, we won't put more money into it, and then it won't get done. And I think that's absolute nonsense. I think it's been proved in so many cases, including your black paint just there, that actually if you open source it and put more minds to it, then the more minds you put to it, the reason why humans have evolved so much is we're using the minds of the whole planet. And now what we're doing is saying, no, only this section of people here are trying to develop it. And I'm sure when the vaccine, we were trying to do the vaccine for COVID, I'm sure all the experts were, I know some of them were trying to lock themselves away, but I'm sure the experts were phoning around going, have you got any advice? Have you, can we help here? Because we're desperately trying to make it. Yeah, so, well, it really is a fascinating subject, but, it's intriguing to know where that ends up, because we only seem to be going the way of more copyright and more patenting. You know, there's so many people I know who are inventing companies, and then I say, oh, what are you going to do? Oh, we're just going to do it to sell it, because they're trying to invent something to sell to one of the bigger ones, and that's become a new way of making money, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's just weird. I don't know. It's not something I understand.
But before we move on, because I'd like to talk about art as well, but there's a big thing recently about artists who say that the AI image generators are copying their style now to make thousands of images. Have you seen this? Because this is also like just throwing another thing into the mix. So I think it's more the sort of animated style, sort of dragons and stuff like that, isn't it? And people are just able to go into software, as I understand it. You're going to have to help me out here, Stuart, because I don't really understand it. But you have to go into software, and then you start want a painting in the style of, and then you put an artist, and then the AI creates.
Yeah,
my head can't get around the idea of that, but that's what's happening, isn't it?
Yeah, I've had a go on it. It completely freaked me out. I asked it to do a poster in the style of Andy Warhol to advertise a can of beans, and it blew my head off. Like, it was 90% there. It's terrifying. It's really good. It's frighteningly good.
What do you think about that then? Is that make your job harder, or does it make it more exciting?
No, it's brilliant, because it happened with music and it happened with filmmaking. And what it meant was that 80% of the stuff we can get the AI to do. And you'll see people having to be really innovative, really kind of like do new things to make it valid. Like, why come to an artist when the computer can do it? Because the artist has an emotional intelligence, can make things computers can't do, can take it a stage further. So it just liberates us. We saw it with the camera. The camera came and people didn't need to paint realistic people anymore. And then artists went on and made abstract art and great art. So it'll just liberate us to explore in a different way.
Brilliant. Love that. And your art, it's like you do a myriad of different styles, don't you? Is that because your art is I hate talking to artists sometimes, because I feel like I'm being really, really stupid trying to get it across.
No.
But is it because in your mind you have like a manifesto or something, and you're trying to explore every single different medium to try and portray your views on how you see things and how you're trying to influence via art? Does that make any sense, or is that just a load of words?
I understand what you mean, but the answer is no. So basically, I'm driven by the idea first. So I get an idea of something I want to articulate or say or respond to, and then I decide the most appropriate medium to do that with. So it might be the most appropriate medium is a poster. The most appropriate medium is a bit of film. The most appropriate medium is an installation. But it's driven by the idea first. So it's idea first and then execution second, which means I play across all sorts of different things, from chemistry to film to dance, collaborate, whatever it is, whatever it needs to be.
Yeah. You've just recently been doing a collaboration with Placebo, haven't you? Which is interesting. Tell us about that one.
Oh, I love Placebo. They're like my favourite band. I've been obsessed with them since I was a teenager. So, I just did a thing for their new record. I made the packaging and I created a paint called Placebo, which is actually based on, I guess, the colour that the band feels like to me, which is a very abstract thing. And I created a painting, and I think we're going to do some more bits together because we really enjoy working on things. But it's been really nice.
Brian, lead singer, please say goodbye. He's like a piece of art in himself, don't you think? He's just been one of the great frontmen with his image.
Yeah, I think he changed a lot, particularly in the 90s, you know, especially in terms of like how men can express themselves. So I think he's really important. He's one of the real artists.
He said to me, I had him on a TV show once, and they were playing, and I had a lovely chat with him. I thought he's such a smart guy. And he says, when you look out on the audience, you can see a sea of of his old haircuts, and he said to me, always be one haircut ahead of your audience. And it just really made me laugh, because I just thought that's kind of very David Bowie-esque and stuff. Always be ahead, don't stick where you are. And you see a lot of the bands, they stay in exactly the same style that they started. They're still in that same style, but you know, he keeps evolving, and he does. And he feels it's an important thing to do. I thought that was a really funny thing to say. Do you think when it comes to art, you were talking about when photography comes along, by the way, apology if this stuff's a bit too basic, but you know, I am fascinated by art. Of course it's tough when you're someone like me and you're talking to an artist. There is this sort of feeling of you feel a bit intimidated by the whole. Oh. Do you understand that?
I do understand that. I'm aware of that. And I know people are scared to even walk into an art gallery or look at new art. And no, I feel you 100%. It's sad it's like that. Hopefully one day it will change. Maybe for the next generation, art won't feel so alien. But I get it.
Bearing in mind art is so important because it's impacting our lives on a daily basis, but sometimes we just don't know it. I remember going to an Anthony Gormley talk, and he was saying that he was an art gallery looking to do his work, and he looked outside and he saw all the people outside, and he thought, why am I putting my art in a gallery when the art's outside? So he's decided to put all his art, you know, all his sculptures and stuff, he decided to start putting them outside so that people could actually get to see them, and he said they should look at them whether they like it or not. And I just thought that was a really interesting thing. And he did say the art gallery in the sort of 20th century became such a snobby place, and like ownership by just a few people, because you're right, people like me started getting intimidated. I don't know if I want to go in there. You know, if I go in there, what will I know? What's happening? Art needs to be accessible, doesn't it?
Oh my gosh, yeah. That's the thing I'm passionate about more than anything, because I know it's really important and it changes people's lives in so many ways. And as you say, we're interacting with it all the time. All the time, but we might not even know it. And people have this idea, oh, I'm too ignorant to talk about art. It's complete nonsense. It's ridiculous. We can have a valid conversation about the latest record that a band made. Why can't we talk about contemporary art? It's the same thing. There's no barrier to entry.
Yeah, and it's slightly annoying that every time it used to be so publicised, the Turner Prize, that immediately as soon as that was announced, I used to love going just to have a look at it, actually. They started moving around the country. Yeah. It used to always be in London. I used to go and look at it, and I used to go with my friend, and we'd pick the winner, knowing nothing about art, but we just picked the one which meant most to us, which I thought was the way to do it, the one which gave us the most emotions, and cool. We'd never agree. But I did like doing that. But as soon as the tabloids saw the Turner, the first thing they do is like, what a load of crap, and especially the time that the guy that dude used manure on his painting. It was like an open door for them, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, they do that.
Yeah, so you know, with art though, it is. I always say it's so important because no one has ever changed my mind on anything with a megaphone. And yet, you just got to look at Bob Marley's work. Like, let's talk about music. Let's call music art, which it is for the time being. But you look at something. Actually, Andy Warhol's work. Really, every time I look at it, I've got a book actually of Andy Warhol's philosophy, and I read through it every now and then.
I've read it.
It's amazing concepts in there, isn't it? It really is. Kind of feels like a bit ahead of its time. I'm not sure if it was, but it does feel that, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
So I was saying, no, nobody changes your mind with a megaphone, but people can change it with art, which is why it's very important for art, and especially when it's social art, like the sort of things you're doing where you're reflecting society, because you can actually have an impact where a article or a megaphone won't do anything. True?
I think that's absolutely true. I'm bang with you on that. I think artists can actually be really useful. And, you know, you cited some musicians there that I think really did make a difference. And I think visual artists do as well. You know, I think we can. And I think you're right. It's not a megaphone. But, you know, I've seen movies and I've listened to music albums that have changed my life. And I think visual art does that too. And it's important.
Yeah, and there's a myriad pictures that we can all, if we all just close our mind, imagine a picture now, there'll be one that comes to you immediately, which is like, wow, that's like a life-changing picture from the news or something we saw, which will really affect the way we thought. Stuart, when did you decide to become an artist? What's your background?
Oh, mate. Well, I always drew since I was very little. But I was very good at science and maths and academic stuff. So coming from a working class family, like saying you want to be an artist is like some sort of Billy Elliot thing around where I was from. So you kind of probably don't want to make a big deal out of that. Artists are cool now. In those days, you get beaten up. So you kind of hid that a little bit. And then I did when I was about 17, kind of. So it was almost like I came out to my parents. You might think I'm really academic and clever, but I'm in love with art. I'm really sorry. And I got this whole, you're going to cut your ear off and die in a garret somewhere. Went to art school and I had a near-death experience as a teenager. And I left art school and I started making art as a way to sort of cope and sort of get through life. And then I became an artist and I started to sell my work and do exhibitions and things.
Do you remember the first piece of work, the first work you sold, and what did it feel like?
Yeah, it was pretty weird. I had this huge anxiety problem after I nearly died, and I put three pictures a day on eBay because it was the only place you can upload an image, and I wanted to share what I was going through with the wider world, and someone bid on it, £2, this little drawing of a, I think it's like an ambulance. From when I was in the hospital, I was like, wow, there's someone out there in the world who's like seen it and bought it. And it's kind of weird. Yeah, really weird.
And when you do art, again, excuse the ignorance of this question. When you put, like, I know lots of musicians and they'll make, I don't know, 50, they'll write 50 songs and think 10 of them are good enough to be put on the album. Is that the same process with you? Have you coming up with 50 ideas and then there's like 10 which are workable?
Oh my gosh, that couldn't be closer to the truth. My painting practice is exactly like a musician. I actually have a list on my wall of about what are kind of like 100 songs, and I might make studies of those. And the ones that I think are worth recording, I'll take into the studio and actually paint. So I work so musically. My process is almost identical to a musician. I'm obsessed with it.
Yeah, I was reading one of your emails the other day when you were saying if you're going through writer's block, get in the studio and blah blah blah, do some, you know, get there, start putting stuff down, etc., etc. And I love that concept. And you said you work to music, and I just wondered then if you're channeling the music, if it's I always imagine an artist has to be in deadly silence, probably barefoot, to try and get the creativity out and not have any influences. Do you not find if you're listening to, you know, if you're listening to punk side of music as a verse to classical, you're not creating two different things?
No, exactly. That's how I use it. So sometimes it needs to be Tchaikovsky, 1812, really flipping loud to paint that bit. And then it needs to be Sex Pistols, and then it needs to be Nirvana. Like, I use it to kind of like get the energy and the momentum and the movement into what I make. And I find the lyrics really inspire my work. So I have a massive blackboard and I'm always writing the words from songs on them, and they can kind of be paintings sometimes in the future. So no, I can't do it without the music. It's no.
Right. Okay. So that's how it is your work an extension of you, or is it separate from you? Is it, when I'm looking at some of your work, am I looking at Stuart Semple? Is that what I'm doing? I'm looking at a piece of you coming out of you. I can't quite think of the word I'm looking for, but is that what I'm looking at?
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, it's clearly me. I mean, I'm there. And I'm present, you know, like Andy Warhol doesn't want to be there, right? He doesn't want to be in the work. But I don't mind being in the work. But what I'm doing, I hope, is holding some sort of mirror up to what's happening in society and maybe giving you my opinion on it. Sort of saying, well, I feel a bit like this about this, and it's making me feel a bit like that, and I think this is what's going on. So I'm kind of like talking about what's happening around me, but in my voice.
And do you ever have any doubts when you're looking at a piece of your work? I was talking to a guy not so long ago who wrote, I'm not going to mention which song it is because it's not fair, he wrote one of the massive, huge hit, from about 10 years ago. And the lyrics are quite strange. And when he wrote them, he sat for ages going, is this brilliant or is this absolute dog shit? And he kept looking at it going, I couldn't work it out. And it ended up being brilliant because everyone bought it and everyone got it and everyone got the concept and understood it. I'll tell you what it is off air, but it's very funny. Do you get that as well?
Oh, all the time. I mean, the thing is, I'm on my own in a room for 12 hours staring at something. So I talk myself into all sorts of weird interpretations of it. I don't have a monkey's by the time I've done it. I've no idea. I've given up the idea of it mattering whether I think it's good or not. The things I think are great, everybody hates. The one I don't like, people are upset. I can't work it out.
Brilliant. How do you value art?
Well, me personally or the world?
No, how do we as I mean, because it's quite a complex thing, isn't it, to value a piece of art, to put a price on it?
Right, so there's two things. The value of something and the price of something are two completely different words. The value of something is how valuable is it? And that could be emotionally, societally. And then the price of something is determined by, in art, what someone's willing to pay for it. And the price goes up if two people are willing to pay a ton of money for it in an auction. And that's how it works. So if two people really want it and they've got very deep pockets, it becomes very valuable.
Yeah, so how do we work out, how do those two people work? How is the art world working? I mean, it's kind of, in 100 meters, you expect the fastest guy to in the world to win, pretty much, you know. So the best players are probably playing football, you know. Maybe the best bands are sort of making it. Are the best artists making it, do you think, or are there lots of artists who just not making it?
No, I think there's probably loads of artists we've never seen making amazing work that, you know, we in their garden shed somewhere. I've no doubt about that. But the art world doesn't need bad art. So by the most part, the galleries and the dealers and the museums are looking for really great art because they don't want to give the public junk. So if I had a record label, I'd probably be looking for a good musician. And I think the art world's still very much like that, at least my experience of it. I mean, there's a very, very commercial end to it, but most of the people I talk to really care about and love art and want to support artists who are making interesting things.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time thinking about ownership at the moment. I don't know why it's become like a little obsession to my, I suppose it's because I read quite a lot of Buddhism and sort of Zen stuff, and it's like non-attachment style theories. And suddenly I was thinking, why do I want to own things? And art being one of them. Why do you think people want to own art?
Well, I mean, first of all, I don't think you can ever own anything because you can't take it with you when you go, can you? So somebody is only ever the custodian of an artwork for a period of time, right? And the likelihood is their kids or grandkids don't like it and they're going to sell it to buy a car or something. So you own it for a while. But I think really there's two things. Do you love it and want to live with it and see it every day, and does it inspire you? And I buy art that I love because I want it near me and it does something to me. Or do you want it for some sort of social status? There's no doubt if you buy £1 million artwork from a big gallery, you'll suddenly get invited to some very posh dinners and you'll get treated very nicely. And it becomes a ticket into a certain social class to buy certain things.
Okay, very interesting. And it's funny. What is it that's gone out of fashion? Is it landscapes, famous landscapes? Is it that which is something like that's gone out of fashion, I read. And so suddenly all these massively expensive pieces of art are suddenly devaluing dramatically because people are just not interested in them at the moment. And it's that's kind of fascinating that it's become that art is fashionable too, I suppose. Like Warhol's not going to go out of fashion, is he? But some of the other ones might come and go, right?
Oh, 100%. I mean, the trends completely change. You know, in the 80s, everyone was buying impressionist work, Van Gogh's, et cetera, et cetera. And then it shifted into contemporary art. And when Warhol was alive in the late 70s, early 80s, his paintings were almost worthless. People weren't interested. He was old fashioned. He was old hat. He was out old news. And now look. So I think it's all cyclical.
What was the impact of Saatchi when he started buying all the Britpop stuff, the Brit art stuff? Because he basically created a whole scene, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to understand he was an ad man as well, so he was a really clever marketer. So you had these quite good artists, some of which I actually really like. And then you had a really good publicist, really hiking the prices. But, I mean, he hurt a lot of artists too, you know. Like, he bought everything they made and really kind of controlled what they were doing. It didn't feel right in a lot of ways, in hindsight, what he did. But at the same time, those artists, well, we'd probably never heard of them and they'd have never carried on making work. I mean, it would have been over without him. So it's really difficult, that patronage thing.
Yeah, and it's funny because a lot of people had a go at a lot of those artists, and yet their work, because some people have devalued it, haven't they, by saying it, one man created the whole scene and it wasn't worth it. But those artists were bloody good, or still are bloody good, aren't they? They're like the Tracy Emins and the Damien Hirst and stuff. They're great artists, aren't they?
Yeah, I think a lot of them were great artists. There's no doubt about it. And so many artists like the Chapman Brothers, Marcus Harvey, like, I can give you a list, Sarah Lucas, they were all in that first Saatchi show. And they're continuing to make incredible work, like right into their 50s, 60s. It was a great era, though, but it was a great era for the UK in general. I mean, don't forget, we had an amazing music scene, really vibrant culture, fashion was good, music was good. It was an amazing moment. So I think what we saw is the art that came with that specific moment that the UK had.
Yeah, and the Unmade Bed, Tracy Emin, I remember thinking, that's a lot of crap. And then I went to see it and I was like, holy shit, that's brilliant. It was just like, when you actually saw it in real life, you're like, fuck, that's amazing. It's like, really makes you feel something. It was really incredible. Yeah. And I wanted so badly to say it was crap. And then it was like, no, it is absolutely amazing as a piece of art. I couldn't get my head around why I was so moved by it. It was fantastic, but it was a time of sort of...
Because it's her real bed, because she really was that low. She really did spend weeks in that bed struggling. And we can all identify with feeling like that. And no one had given us that before.
Yeah, and it was what's weird about the 90s. It's thought of as the lad culture, but it was also the time that women were also encouraged to be... I'm going to use this word, it's a horrible word, but a ladder, as in you're allowed to talk about yourself for once. And someone like Tracy coming along saying, that is a bed where I was feeling really shit and stuff like that. It's like, wow, that was a really interesting time, I thought, you know, a fascinating piece of art.
Yeah.
What do you think then? Like you were saying, the 90s was all buoyant and it was exciting and there was Britpop and all that. At the moment, it's horrific. The, the cost of living crisis. I don't know why I'm laughing, because it's not funny. The fuel prices, cost of living crisis. I mean, the government, when I'm talking to you now, I don't know whether we're still going to have the same prime minister by the time this goes out, but the government's an absolute mess at the moment.
Yeah. And
everything seems horrific. You mentioned earlier, greedy. The world seems obsessed with greed. There seems to be nothing, no one looking after society at all. No one seems to care. There's a war going on in Russia. Is that, I mean, must be a massive time for an artist to be reflecting that. Is this being reflected in your thoughts at the moment and your work?
Oh, 100%. I can't get away from it. You know, I'm in here making my work with that going on out there, and it's a complete mess. And I, you know, it'd be completely wrong to come in here and not respond to that in some way. I mean, how can you ignore that? I mean, it's horrendous.
Yeah, so the landscape and the backdrop is very important to you, isn't it, when you're creating your sort of art? But there are other artists who will just, I suppose, they get locked into what they're doing, and then that's just that's their sort of, you know, that's their portfolio, and that's what they're going to carry on making.
Yeah, I mean, everyone's different. You know, it's not morally better or worse to respond to society. It's just kind of my subject, you know. There's people who paint really good pictures of cats. They're obsessed with cats. They're the best cat painter. But it's just not what rocks my boat. You know, I'm interested in culture.
Yeah, it's interesting when you actually start looking around at art. I'm fascinated by Damien Hirst and I follow him. I don't need you to comment on this, but I'm fascinated by the quantity of the same piece of art that he does. And I don't know whether he's always done that, but it's just, he's in these, I mean, it's great. Follow him, and anyone who's listening says, follow him on Instagram, because what he's doing, he creates these paintings that, and I want to own them. They're huge and they're lovely. And he did one on sort of the cherry blossom recently, which looked just absolutely amazing. But he's doing so many of them. And I couldn't kind of get my head around it, because I always thought with art, it was about doing one of something, not like 50 of them. They're all different because he's painting them all different, but they're all the same concept. It's quite strange, that, to me.
I think you can go either way. I mean, Warhol said a can of Coke is the same whether you're the Sultan of Brunei or a homeless guy. And I think Warhol wanted to make as many copies of his things as possible and give them to as many people. So someone like Damien, he sees it like a production line, like a factory, like he's making lots of work and da-da-da. I mean, I make a handful of paintings a year and I care about each one, and it's just different. It's a different way of being.
Yeah, it is. Interestingly, I watched that KLF documentary. I know you talked about this the other day.
Oh, mate, good.
I found it such a hard watch. I'm sorry. I mean, brilliant. I always say there's two sorts of art for me. The ones that make me sort of kind of feel like philosophical or something. I like looking at those. Like I've got some great art downstairs with just some slogany type things, which I absolutely love. And then there's art which I won't keep in my house, which disturbs me. And so you go into, it's like one of the Matisse pieces just disturbs me looking at it. And there's a few bits of art like that. And I look at it and I go, I just actually don't like that. It's making me feel ill. But that is also, I think, good art. There was an artist once who just had I can't remember who it was now, just had a running tap. Do you remember in one of the art galleries, just to talk about how water was being wasted and just had a tap on in a gallery, and it was just running water constantly, and people kept coming and turning it off because they couldn't stand watching it. And I was like, I love that sort of stuff, because I was only watching it on a TV thing. I didn't actually go and see it, and I was going, that guy's so painful to watch that, because we are all programmed to want to turn taps off. Do you know what I mean? Don't let this thing keep going. Yeah, and so when I was watching the KLF and they were going to burn the money, I was like, oh, don't. What are you doing? Why are you doing this? What did you make of that? It was kind of such a bizarre thing, wasn't it?
I don't know. It was really weird. But I've got to know Jimmy quite well, and we've done some bits together. So I've spoken to him a lot about the whole thing. And the truth is they honestly don't know why they burnt the money. Like, I swear, they have no idea why they did it. And I think when you realise they don't know why they burnt the money, that's just, what else is there to say? Like, they did it, and Jimmy regrets it.
Why does he regret it? Just because of the way people are towards them now?
No, I genuinely think he burnt £1 million and had to go home to his family with no money, and was like, oh God, I've burnt a lot. Like, I literally am now poor. I could, now what are we going to do? I think it's more like that. I mean, that's my interpretation
of
it. You know.
Yeah, well, I think they just wanted to sort of inflict mental pain on themselves somehow as well. I mean, that's what came across in the documentary. They were, you know, I think with a lot of artists, it's like, how can I get some sort of feeling of something? And they went to the extreme levels of getting feeling, didn't they? You know, I always wonder if Van Gogh cut his ear off because he was looking for feeling. I mean, I don't know. You know, it's just something I was thinking of. Listen, your shop, which I love, and, you know, I'm tempted to buy everything on it. I'm not going to because I've got nothing to do with it, but I'm tempted to because I really like it. Would you say...
Thank you.
Would you say it's like art in itself, that?
Do you think it might be? I don't know. Yeah, it definitely is. Yeah, the whole thing.
Yeah, because it's just amazing that the all these stuff on it. I feel myself having mass desire. I'm not, you know, I do art with my kid all the time, but I'm not sure what I would do with all those things. Mm. But the one that really stood out for me was the gay blood. Can you explain that?
Oh yeah, I'm glad to explain that. So in America, the FDA for a long time have had a very discriminatory policy against men who sleep with other men giving blood, basically. So when you rock up to donate blood, if you're a homosexual male, you tick the box and they tell you to get lost. Whereas most countries now screen the blood with science, right? They test the blood rather than screening with stigma, which I think is wrong. So I work with my friends in New York from an agency called Mother. They do loads of ads for like IKEA and things like that, very creative. And all their employees, the gay male employees at Mother, donated their blood. And I turned it into a series of art materials so that other people could paint with that blood, sign protest with the blood, make work about this and try and raise a bit of awareness about how this policy is actually kind of really harmful, especially with a shortage of blood at the moment. It's ludicrous now to be acting like this.
Yeah. Yeah, it made an impact when I looked at it, actually. And I suppose that's what it's all about. But your whole shop has been impactful to me, because I'm looking at these things and going, hold on, the glitteriest glitter. How do you make that work then?
How does the glitteriest glitter work?
Yeah.
Well, it's little shards of glass. So tiny little shards of glass that are cut at different angles, but the glass is 99.9% clear, so you can see straight through it. But the interesting thing about a pot of glass is if you went to dip your middle finger in it, it would probably cut your finger. So maybe that's more of why I came out with it after I made the pink.
All right, okay. So the pink's the pinkest pink, the white's the whitest white. Does that mean it's more reflective than other whites? Am I in the right level here, because the black was more matte? Is the white more reflective?
Exactly. It bounces back, I think, 99.8% of visible light. So it's very bright. Yes.
Ah, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. What are you doing next? Are you going to create more products?
I don't know. Do you know what? I want to resurrect really ancient paints that we haven't been able to use since the medieval ages. So there's all these old forgotten pigments that are just like hidden to history. So I want artists to be able to use those, because I think it'd be really cool, because some of them were brilliant.
Excellent. And whilst I've got you here, can I ask you, if you were listening to this and you're not into art, and because I will have some listeners who are not into art listening to this, and it's whet your appetite, what would you suggest people do apart from just flick around? Because I do think flicking around the internet's good, but you know, like I was looking at one of your pieces of art today, I can't remember the name of it, I'm so sorry, but the sort of smiley face ball stuck in the alleyway.
Yeah, it's called I Should Be Crying But I Just Can't Let It Show, which is after a Kate Bush lyric.
Brilliant. And I'm looking at that thinking, that's just so cool. And then I thought, I bet you if I'd seen it in real life, though, it'd have had much more impact on me, like Tracy Emin's bed. So what would you suggest for people to do? How would you best suggest people go about trying to get into art and getting the feelings going from viewing this stuff?
I think you've got to go and see it. You know, go to your local museum or art gallery and spend time in front of it. And if you haven't got access to one, then maybe like YouTube is actually really good. And you can follow the Tate on YouTube, and they make these amazing little 5-minute short films with some of the artists. And you'll get to very quickly see living artists making stuff. And you might find one or two that you're really interested in. And then maybe you could go a bit further and really look into what they're up to.
Brilliant. I asked a lot of the people who come on here the same questions, so I'm going to ask you this. I'm sorry, I don't think you've been briefed on this, so I hope it,
go on, then.
What's one piece of advice? What's one piece of advice that's been invaluable to you that you can give our listeners?
Yes, it's a very important art dealer, Anthony Doffé, total legend, and he actually bought Warhol to London, and he told me, just keep your head down and keep making your stuff.
Brilliant.
And it's fundamentally served me really well. So I think Anthony was right.
Good. Okay. The next question is, have you ever seen a UFO or a ghost? I'm just a bit obsessed with this, Stuart, because I've never seen, I want to have seen one, but I've never seen anything. So I ask all my guests if they've seen them.
Okay. I think it's a yes to both. I think it's a yes to both, too.
Wow. Where have you seen a UFO?
Well, I was cycling with my friends through the New Forest as a teenager, and this big light came over and it did this mad thing, and then it shot off, and it wasn't a star and it definitely wasn't a plane. So, yeah, I mean, it was unidentified, it was flying, it was some sort of object. So, yeah, I think I've seen one.
Brilliant. Ghost, where have you seen that?
So this is really freaky. As about 6 year old, I rolled over in my bed in the middle of the night, and my Uncle Dinky was lying next to me in the bed. and he died a few weeks before from cancer. And I ran out into the hallway and was like shaking and like white, like as if you've seen a ghost. And yeah, I can still remember it. So either I was really traumatized by his death and it did some weird psychological thing and I was half asleep, or my Uncle Dinky really came back to see me. I don't know.
Which one do you think it is?
I like to believe he came.
Okay. Final question for you. What is the meaning of life? And you might have a good view on this because you had your near-death experience. So it might have changed the way you look at life.
To help one another.
Tell us about your near-death experience. What actually happened to you?
Oh, God. Well, I was studying art.
You don't have to.
No, I can tell you. I was studying art at the Yorkshire Sculpture Park, and I always had this weird feeling if I went home to visit my mum, something bad would happen. And I bought a sandwich from a motorway service station, and I was allergic to it, and all my lips swelled up and my tongue. And I was with my girlfriend at the time in the car, and it was quicker to get the train, so I went on the train on my own, and I got to my mum's house and I flopped on her doorstep and I was kind of dying from this allergy. And they took me to hospital, but none of the normal allergy stuff actually worked. It just didn't work. And they sort of said, oh, it's not a case of if you go, it's when you go. And my throat was getting smaller and smaller. And I sort of said goodbye to all my family. And this doctor decided he had this bag of plasma stuff from another hospital. And he put it on a drip on me because he thought it would stop it. And I was allergic to it. And I flatlined and essentially died, didn't I? And then I came back and everything was a bit weird for a long time after that.
Do you remember, please stop me if you don't want me to ask you these questions, but do you remember flatlining? Do you remember what happened to you? Do you have any feelings from when you went flatlined, basically?
Yeah. So afterwards, I got really obsessed with reading all the books about near-death experiences, and mine wasn't really typical. So I felt very much like I was becoming one with everything else, like some sort of consciousness thing. And it was really, really beautiful and really like, oh my God, it was incredible. But I also had this strong sense that I had a choice and I didn't really want to do that, even though it was beautiful. And then I kind of came back. And it was like really beautiful. It wasn't scary. And I probably could have gone along with it, but I didn't really want to.
Oh, that feels great, actually, hearing that, because it does feel like I've read that a few times, actually. The feeling of dying is actually one of beauty. And you do feel like you're going back into a consciousness. And I think that's amazing. So listen, Stuart, thank you so much for joining me today. I recommend anyone go to culturehustle.com. Is there anywhere else they should go to see any of your work?
Yeah, if you just type Stuart Semple into Google, you'll find my Instagram and everything. So just put my name. Oh, and it's myname.com is my website if you want to see all my arty stuff.
Okay, and what's the next thing you're doing? What's the next project we can see?
Well, I'm just in here. I'm soldiering on with this new collection of paintings. I'm trying to get sort of maybe 10 or 12 together. So hopefully early next year, I might have a show in London of those, which would be really good.
Marvellous. I'll definitely come along and see.
Yeah,
come. Thank you so much, Stuart, for joining me.
Thank you for having me.